listening to the American Exception Podcast. I'm Aaron Good, and in this episode, I have the privilege of being joined by pod friend Ben Howard. This is kind of a funny episode. I mean, it's deadly dead serious, but it was not exactly planned. We were scheduled to continue our Peter Dale Scott series, but Peter postponed because he was a little under the weather. So I asked Ben if he were up for doing an episode on Ukraine, even though we had not planned anything for it. The title, you probably guessed, is a reference to the fact that for years, various parties of U.S., Russian, Ukrainian, and even Nazi origin have been fooling around, and with this historic Russian military operation, it is now a time for finding out some things. We are, of course, hoping for a turn toward justice and peace as soon as possible. So with that bit of prologue out of the way, here's our discussion. I'm here with Ben Howard, and we're going to be talking about the insanity going on in the world today. And with any luck, we'll all still be around, and this podcast will be able to be released because we won't all be a bunch of ashes. So, Ben Howard, it's great to have you here.
Always great to be here.
So, this whole business in Ukraine, I was surprised that the invasion happened to some degree. The reporting was very strange. We talked about this a little bit with Peter Dale Scott at the end, and I was listening to it again thinking, like, what was I actually saying? Did I actually say they would never invade? And I don't think I said that. I just said that the reports were really crazy and that they were saying that, oh, it's going to happen on Thursday. And then it just was very strange. But then it did happen. What do you think about this now that we're a couple weeks into it? What's your take on where we are at right now?
I'm definitely very concerned about the way that this whole thing has become exacerbated, and you know the prospect of this Cold War with Russia, which has been brewing for a long time at this point, becoming a hot war, and possibly expanding more widely in Europe is very concerning to me. Obviously, the situation in Ukraine, I mean, as a state, it probably is not going to exist the way it has, you know, until now. But the idea that this would spill over in a wider way, either in the short term or over the longer term, you know, over the next several years, there don't seem to be any off ramps, and there seems to be very little diplomacy at the higher levels going on. And I think if you go back to some of the Russian demands for this kind of new security guarantees that they were asking for, and sort of intransigence on NATO's part to even respond to them in any way, shape, or form, I think that bodes poorly for how the next several years of relationships between Russia and NATO go. So definitely a concerning moment.
Yeah, I think as far as off-ramps go, it's pretty straightforward what would be satisfactory to the Russians if they would insist on Donbass being, you know, that region being autonomous, you know, being an independent state, and they would, on the recognition of Crimea. And at this point, I don't see how Ukraine can reverse either of those facts on the ground. And those are places that are majority Russian, so that they don't want to be part of this Ukrainian state. And I think one of the first things one of the U.S. puppets did, maybe Petro,
Poroshenko.
Every time I try to say his name, I think Count Chocula,
because oh no,
he's like a chocolate robber baron. So like his real name, I actually always escapes me. I just think Count Chocula, but if I just said that, people would think that there was something wrong with the podcast. But one of the first things he did was outlaw the Russian language. And so, you know, you see that there's like hostility there that's not going to be, they're not really going to come back. So the off ramps seem like they're there. I would only disagree in that, like, they're there, but the chance is not that there doesn't seem to be any inclination to allow anybody to take them. Like, you know, I mean, what are the Russian demands? Are that they recognize those areas, recognize Crimea, and remain demilitarized and neutral? What are the prospects of Ukraine from stopping any of those things from becoming reality if they don't negotiate for them?
Yeah, I mean, this is the nature of great powers and small states next to great powers. I mean, Ukraine is not a small state, you know, in the grand scheme of things, but relative to Russia, it definitely is. And, you know, despite a lot of Western obfuscation about what is going on the ground, you know, it does seem like the Russians are going to achieve whatever military objectives they set out to. And so it seems unlikely to me that there could be a military resistance, certainly to Crimea. I mean, I don't see how Ukraine's military could recapture Crimea. I don't think that that's possible. And I think, I mean, they're getting pushed back steadily. I mean, the Ukrainian military is getting, cauldroned and surrounded down in the southeast. So it doesn't seem possible that they could push back on Donbass either. So, I mean, I think the prospects for a military victory of some kind, in terms of a conventional military versus conventional military to do what conventional militaries do, it doesn't seem credible at this point in time. So, you know, why the West and why the U.S. continues this idea that there can be a credible conventional military conflict here, I don't understand. It just seems to me to be throwing the country or keeping the country in this fire when there should be, you know, de-escalation at this point. But as far as the, you know, however this particular situation gets resolved with respect to Ukraine, there are broader Russian concerns, you know, with respect to missile bases in Poland, for instance, missile bases in Romania, just as an example, you know. So I don't think that this, you know, if the logic of this is that the Russians are not willing to tolerate this security crisis with respect to Ukraine on their border, then does that stop at that point when there are so many other security, you know, they have so many other security concerns? And again, you know, whether you regard that as legitimate or illegitimate, the fact of the matter is Russia is a major military power in Eastern Europe, and they certainly have voted. So, you know, I again, however this issue gets resolved, the longer term, and the broader issues that have set the stage for this, I don't think are going to be resolved anytime soon, particularly given that, you know, Poland and Romania, for instance, are both NATO members and have Article 5 protections and all of that. So, you know, that just brings in a much, much broader set of players than the conflict with Ukraine, which seems mostly to be pushed by the U.S. With some minor partnership from some of the European partners.
Right, because this seems like it's going to be very damaging to the European economy, and the German economy especially. There's a great quote from the guy that was the founder of Stratfor, where he says that the main objective of U.S. foreign policy, over which two world wars were fought, was to prevent the any sort of union between Russia and Germany, because with German industrial might and Russian natural resources and this large, you know, workforce, etc., that they would be able to produce a countervailing force over Anglo-US hegemony. And it seems from the, like with Germany, you just wonder why they haven't broken away from the U.S. and just thrown their lot in with the Russians. I mean, it seems so clear, like the Nord Stream 2 thing, all this cheap gas that they can get to fuel their industry, yeah, and they're not doing it. Is this going to end up, will Europe stay in the American orbit if it means taking on great economic hardship? Or do you have any idea how this might play out in the coming years?
I mean, if you look at the logic of it, you know, and even if you look at the fact that Nord Stream 2 and Nord Stream 1, you know, got as far as they did, it seems pretty obvious, like you say, that, you know, here's Germany, here's Russia. Russia has all these mineral resources. Germany has no mineral resources besides, you know, a little bit of coal, and they need those for their economy and just to heat their citizens' homes, you know. So the just straight, you know, economic relationship there seems very obvious. And, you know, invading Russia was an animating concern for the German elite for many, many, many years, with I think with an eye towards those things, you know, the resources and so, but on the other hand, I think that you know, decades and decades at this point of American involvement at all levels of European politics, you know, up to corrupting, you know, some of the top leaders, you know, down to propaganda campaigns and even, you know, terrorism, false flag terrorism campaigns against the European populace. I think that American control over European politics is pretty secure at this point. So despite how disastrous this whole situation I think is going to turn out to be for the average person in Europe, I think that it seems pretty much like that NATO partners, Germany foremost among them, is going to it's going to truck along and do whatever the Americans say. I think also it should not be lost that, you know, for instance, Germany doesn't have a seat on the as a permanent member on the Security Council. They don't have nuclear weapons, unlike France, which has both of those things. But France is a much weaker economic power than Germany is. So Germany really relies on American, you know, this American umbrella in many important respects. So they're really tied to the Americans, even though the US doesn't have a lot to offer Germany apart from an export market for luxury automobiles. You know, there's not really much that the US can do to help Germany, for instance, with its gas problem. So again, I think for the average person, you know, this is pretty disastrous, but I think that there are a lot of, you know, elites and business leaders, et cetera. Although honestly, even business leaders in Germany are gonna, you know, be chafing under this whole situation. You know, Merkel tried to walk some kind of line between the two, find some kind of way to not completely shut Russia out of the German economy. But you know, with these recent developments, that seems pretty much dead at this point.
Yeah, and the unanimity of the propaganda in the U.S. orbit is, I think, as it's on. They've set it to 11. I mean, it's like it does. The only thing you can think of is like Spinal Tap. It's like, damn, they turned it back up to 11. It hasn't been up this high since the Iraq War, really, even Russiagate. But like putting these things into context, I mean, the things that get omitted from this story, which are key, is from the U on the US side, the mainstream coverage, to my knowledge, and if somebody is more steeped in this than me, correct me on this, but I don't really listen to NBC, NPR or read the New York Times that much anymore. Sometimes I might want to know what the propaganda is, so I'll read the New York Times. But from what I glean, the coverage does not speak much about the fact that NATO expansion was promised, not to be something in the offing to Gorbachev. It is a condition for allowing Germany to reunite. And the or nor is the fact that Russia, even when Russia was a US puppet, a regime for a while under Yeltsin, they wouldn't allow them to join NATO. So, that part is blacked out. Or so it does. If you don't mention it, then it doesn't really need to be explained. The nuclear angle with these missiles in missile systems in Poland and Romania are typically not mentioned or mentioned in a superficial way. The 2014 coup is not discussed as a coup, even though it's the most well-documented coup that the US has pulled off. I mean, there's more coming out to have exposed this, and yet because it's inconvenient, they're saying that it's just memory hold. It's like, no, this is not what happened. The people rose up against a corrupt government and put this guy in. But it's like, but there's so much. You have the woman
Yeah,
on tape.
replaced him with Poroshenko, who is himself incredibly corrupt, you know, like, so, yeah.
And so that angle is also, ridiculous. Putin's statements on this that I have read, there are parts where he speaks about the historic relationship between Ukraine and Russian people, but to say and that, but these end up being a small part of what he has actually said about this over the years, and that is the only part that they talk about, and they speak of this as aha, blood and soil. He's a Hitler. So, given that there seems to be no daylight for like alternate for like the reality of the situation to even be openly discussed, and let's not forget Russiagate, which has been thoroughly debunked in all of its major tenets, and yet there's been no reckoning for that, which is also alarming, because to me that sort of sustained denial and black is white propaganda campaign indicates it's just more proof that there is a long-standing establishment antipathy towards Russia and antagonism towards Russia that is huge. And the Syria angle as well has never, it's never acknowledged that, like, yeah, that was basically a U.S. war, and Russia, in accordance with international law, by and large, intervened to protect an ally from being overthrown by U.S.-backed jihadis. Probably made the U.S. even angrier at them. So with all these things left out of the actual discussion that are very important to assessing it, do you see much chance that there's that a more realistic counter narrative can enter the discussion and somehow influence policy here, or where do they go after all of this?
I think as far as the general public is concerned, I think only some kind of big event that would all of a sudden shake Americans into their senses would be the only thing that could really do that, because as you say, even basic historical facts about, like you say, the post-Cold War settlement of how to have a secure Europe, how to prevent a war in Europe, the question of what is Russia's role going to be in that, and they were pretty clearly sidelined. I mean, there was a lot of talk about the OSCE replacing NATO, and the OSCE would include Russia, and that was going to be sort of the forum for preventing a European war, essentially. But that never happened, and the OSCE has basically been a defunct organization essentially since it was created. On the other hand, NATO remains the way of the U.S. I mean, Bush even explicitly said this to Helmut Kohl during the German reunification debates, that if we don't have NATO, then what is the justification for the U.S. keeping troops in Europe, which... like it or not, is a major component. I mean, the U.S. has a huge number of troops in Germany.
They're like an occupied country. People don't realize that.
This is the thing. Nominally, the soldiers are there with the consent of the government, and that is true. But on the other hand, this is a government that literally owes its existence to the United States. I mean, Germany would not have reunified the way that it did without American involvement in that process. And the Americans really pushed it a certain way, contrary to what, for instance, a lot of European leaders wanted. For instance, in Britain and France, they opposed the specific way that Germany was reunified, because they understood, these are leaders of would be or has been or could be great powers in Europe who don't want American domination, or who didn't want American domination at that point over Europe to be as secure and solid as it has become and as it has been for a long time. So the going back to this question of how do you understand what's happening when all of these important facts are concealed and suppressed and even straight up outright censored at this point, I'm really not certain, and I wonder, I guess I worry even more about the people who make these decisions, the people in the State Department, the people in the Defense Department, the people in charge of major corporations in this country who, control the purse strings. If they are also so disconnected from reality, that poses a serious threat, because that is when you have this disconnect between your appraisal of the world and the way that the world actually is, and you're dealing with a conflict between nuclear states, that poses serious problems, even if it doesn't reach the level of nuclear confrontation. Even a major conventional war in Europe would be so devastating. And again, it doesn't seem like, if you can't acknowledge the reality of the circumstance and try to work, engage in the difficult work of compromise and negotiation and try to settle this thing in some way other than war, but if your appraisal of the situation just completely obfuscates all of the actual issues and structural problems that have led to this situation, that basically becomes impossible. So, you know, that's part of the reason why I'm so, I don't think that there's going to be an off-ramp, in terms of the overall, you know, security situation between Russia and the West.
I mean, the strange thing is that there does seem to be more common sense among the whack jobs that run the Pentagon than there is among the public at this point, or the media. It's an NPR thing with a general or some Pentagon spokesman, and they keep asking about a no-fly zone repeatedly. And the Pentagon person is having to explain, like, well, that would be a major escalation and could lead to a nuclear conflagration. So this is not something that we're considering this time. And the NPR person is like indignant about it. Yeah. And it's like, imagine if there was this nuclear standoff and Buck Turgidson from Doctor Strangelove is sent out to talk to the press, and he has to be like the voice of reason. I mean, that's where we're at now.
Yeah.
It's like they've really so successfully, the war machine has so successfully turned the corporate media and even the fake alternative media into, you know, warmongering, pro-empire propagandists that they've overshot the actual people in charge of running the, this supremely violent and destructive empire, because at least those people have to be somewhat aware of reality. Whereas like these other people, apparently their job is to have no connection to reality at all. Yeah. And just to like take a cartoon version of what the empire once put out there and put it out there ad nauseum. I mean, I can't remember a point where the media was more aggressive than the actual military in the U.S., although maybe there are examples. But can you think of anything like this?
Not really. I mean, maybe going back to some of the yellow journalism, like, but even that, you know, was arguably, you know, funded by some of the military interests. But that is really the only thing I can think of. And I wonder, with respect to the no-fly zone stuff specifically, I mean, I just think for so long the U.S. has picked on states which really can't do anything and don't have an air force to speak of or an air defense to speak of. So basically the U.S. with respect to no-fly zones was omnipotent, essentially. Even Yugoslavia, Serbia did have at least some functioning air defense, and a lot of American and European pilots did get shot down, but nothing on the scale like what would happen if the U.S. tried to fly planes over Ukraine today. I mean, the Eastern Russia is probably the most inhospitable airspace on Earth. You know, thousands of missile, you know, surface-to-air missile sites. You'd have to hit Russian air bases in Russia. You'd have to hit Belarusian. I mean, it would mean a massive war on Russia to be
probably a nuclear war within hours, right? I mean,
exactly. If the U.S. starts trying to hit surface-to-air missile sites in eastern Russia, which they would need to, just given the range of those missiles that they would easily be able to hit into Ukraine if Americans were flying over Ukraine, that would not be received very well, I don't think. And even before it got to a nuclear confrontation, you know, Russian military has the ability to hit, air bases, American bases in Germany with conventional cruise missiles and ballistic missiles. And so even before you got to the level of nuclear confrontation, it would put a huge number of American personnel at risk. You know, this is also the issue in Southwest Asia as well. And that, you know, the Iranians demonstrated that they can put missiles on an American, you know, if you recall, after the U.S. assassinated Qasem Soleimani, the Iranians retaliated by, you know, with a lot of advance warning and trying to minimize the casualties, but they were able to put some of their older, you know, much, much weaker missiles on an American airbase in Iraq. And I think American planners understand, you know, if Iran wanted to, a lot of American soldiers in Southwest Asia are at serious risk if it, you know, erupted into a serious war. So I think that's what is animating a lot of the, you know, Defense Department trying to put the brakes on this and remind people, hey, you know, this is a very different situation than the U.S. has been in the past. And I also wonder, just sort of psychologically, it's, you know, how even amongst people who are nominally opposed to, for instance, the war in Iraq or something like this, you know, even that is based on the bedrock idea that the U.S. can do whatever it wants, and it's really a question of should we or is it prudent to do this. But it's not often that the U.S. is faced with there are no military options in this situation. And I wonder if that's a difficult pill to swallow for a lot of people who are generally speaking just ignorant about military affairs, which I think is most people.
I mean, even my I'm not expert on the actual material capabilities of both sides, but it's not that hard once to extrapolate once you understand the basic contours of mutually assured destruction.
Yeah,
it's criminal. There aren't even words to express how immoral and sinister the U.S. actions, I mean, since the end of the Cold War, have been in terms of, like, you know, not backing out of nuclear disarmament treaties. Yeah. There should have been a major move towards more nuclear disarmament, not less. They shouldn't have been trying to make nuclear weapons more usable like Obama did. Obama came to office talking about, you know, he'd even talked about reducing U.S. nuclear capabilities. He ends up making it worse. The way that these people are imperiling our existence is, with these nuclear weapons, it is difficult to even begin to say how evil this is. And we can't do much about it, apparently. And, could somehow this be used to sober people up if they're able to find a way out of this? I mean, this rules-based order is insane. It basically, if the closest thing that you can compare it to in practice, and that this I know is kind of beyond the pale for what most people say about this, but it's an international version of the Fuhrer principle. It's yeah. Basically that everything has to be geared towards what the hegemon says is going to be. And if there's any deviation from that, the hegemon can take whatever steps it wishes to crush that which opposes it. I mean, yeah. That's pretty much it. And this is what we're defending.
Yeah. The strong do what they will and the weak bear what they must. And that is basically the animating principle of American foreign policy, which is pretty horrifying, especially if you are, you know, in the gun sights. And even if you're nominally an ally, I mean, if you're in Europe, I mean, this was known during the Cold War, and there were huge protests at various different points in Europe against, expanding the cruise missile arsenal in Europe, expanding the intermediate range nuclear missiles in Europe. You know, certainly a lot of the arms control came from people in the military establishment on both sides saying, you know, we need to cool this down, otherwise we put ourselves in danger. But a lot of it also was just grassroots from people who said, you know, hey, I don't want to be a target. I don't want a missile launcher in my backyard because that makes me a target for somebody else's missile launcher, which is a very rational, normal response.
Imagine if you're like at your house, you've got a suburban home, and some guy comes to your house and says, hey, you got some empty space in your backyard. How about I put a cruise missile there?
Yeah.
What could keep you safer than that? It's like,
yeah, exactly. This whole idea of peace through strength, I mean, how many times does this have to be disproven? You know, first off, the one who is strong, if they're stronger enough than their enemies, which the U.S. has been, especially since 1991, in fact, there's no peace from strength. The strong one does what they will. They attack countries, basically, who, as you said, who violate their diktats, who don't go along with what they want to do. And on the other hand, if you do face another strong opponent, then you're just in an arms race with them. And, Europe has had the experience of what that leads to twice so far in the past, 100 years, roughly. And, I don't think we're at like a World War II situation or anything like that. The level of militarization and buildup of forces is nothing even close to that at this point. But, you know, one of the very bad signs in the interwar period between World War I and World War II was basically the collapse of arms control. I mean, after World War I, there were a lot of attempts to limit, naval tonnage and the size of ships and the amount of artillery pieces. And this was also done at the very end of the Cold War. The Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty was an attempt to, in a lot of respects, it was an attempt by NATO to limit the Warsaw Pact's conventional forces, which were widely acknowledged as being vastly superior to what NATO could bring to bear. But nonetheless, very good for people in Europe to have, you know, smaller armies, less equipment. But that's all gone at this point, and it's just completely unrestrained. And, you know, the consequences of that kind of arms buildup without some kind of countervailing force to bring arms control into the picture again, which does not seem to be in the offing to me from what I can see, it sets up a very, very bad situation. I mean, you know, the two sides building armies up, you know, on either sides of the border, it very rarely ends well.
Yeah, I have come to the conclusion, and I wrote about this in my dissertation, and I expanded on it more afterwards when I did some revisions to it. I had conversations with Dan Ellsberg, and he pointed me to a book written by a historian, a diplomatic historian, about the war scare of Harry Truman and the war scare of 1948, mm-hmm. which was basically that the aerospace industry in the U.S. was in huge trouble and needed only massive government support would save it. And its main creditor was Chase Bank, you know, to the tune of billions of dollars. So you're talking about Rockefeller, you're talking about the heart of American capitalism, right? The upper echelon of it was tied to the aerospace industry. And so using a number of really dubious tidbits, they created this war scare to get Congress to send a bunch of money to the aerospace industry. You have the problems of 1949, which is that the Soviet Union acquires the bomb and China goes communist. But even then, they know that actually the Soviets are not looking to take over Western Europe. But there's a huge problem in that Marshall funding is supposed to run out, and it's not going to solve the economic problems of Western Europe. So they have to figure out what to do. And the way that they respond to this is eventually written into policy in the form of NSC 68, which said at the time that if you read it carefully, there's even acknowledgments in there that the Soviet threat the threat from the Soviets is not so much that they will launch a massive, you know, German style invasion and take over Western Europe. It's that the countries will become neutral, that they will start trading a little more. And first you buy a little bit of wheat from Russia, and then you buy a little bit of gas, and then, you know, soon there are communists in your own country saying, why can't we be communists? And, you know, this is kind of what they're pointing to. And so the creation of the rearmament that they call for, this massive rearmament, is in part to solve the dollar gap in Western Europe and also in East Asia with Japan that they're trying to build up. So because their problem is that there's nobody to buy these things that America is producing. So there's not enough, there wouldn't be enough trade between the countries without some major changes. The Marshall funding was going to run out.
Yeah.
And so they gin up this Soviet boogeyman who's 100 feet tall in order to reorient the U.S. towards massive rearmament campaign, and which leads to the creation of the military industrial complex. But it also more tightly integrates European economic integration with the U.S. And this ends up happening with Japan also. And it sets up what we think of as the bipolar world of the Cold War, where finance and trade flows are going across both oceans with the U.S. as the center of gravity. And this is how the U.S. was able to maintain hegemony all after World War II, that it was this huge power untouched by World War II devastation. And it created this capitalist system over which it reigned hegemonic. And the creation of this military-industrial complex involved cordoning off these other areas, you know, with the Cold War. And so there wouldn't be trade between, you know, Russia and the U.S. backsides and China. And it was in danger of sort of coming apart with the end of the Soviet Union, even though Russia was a basket case. And we see we've talked so much about 9/11. And the desire to integrate, for the U.S. to somehow take control over those areas. But it seems like that has failed, you know, in a number of ways, that things have not gone. The global war on terror, which was really a war for hegemony over Eurasia, that has failed. And so it seems like the U.S. is falling back to trying to recreate a bipolar world with its response here. But is this even possible? I mean, you notice Taiwan. It almost seems like the U.S. has been trying to provoke something with Taiwan to serve as a pretext for this too. I mean, where do you think that this Is this a gambit by the U.S. to try to do this because all of their other the efforts of this declining empire have failed, and so they're just resorting to some sort of like naked recreation of a Cold War mentality because they've provoked Russia so much and crossed so many explicitly stated red lines that this really should come as not a surprise to anyone. But what do you think that they bargained on this invasion or not? I mean, what do you make of this, the way that things changed so quickly over a few months, or at least they seem to have changed, although when you look back at it, it is more incremental and the Russian response is more predictable when you look back at it soberly. But where do you see this going in the context of the Cold War and then the War on Terror and how things shook out there?
If you look back at some of the DoD planning, like Joint Vision 2020 and stuff like that, this idea of full spectrum dominance, which, you know, was applied specifically to a specific battle space, but I think also was emblematic of strategic thinking that the U.S. is going to run the world, essentially. And, you know, that's just not realistic. That's a ridiculous idea to think that a country could do that for any length of time. And, you know, when you look, for instance, at some, because a lot of the, I think a lot of the, I agree, it does, it doesn't, I don't understand how it will be possible to do this. And that's why I doubt that it will be successful. Because, you know, the Chinese economy and the Russian economy as well, in very different ways, they're so tightly integrated with the entire rest of the world's economy. I mean, the number of consumer goods that are produced in China and as with respect to China's relationship with the poorer countries as well, you know, the amount of steel and concrete and just basic things like that that China produces that these countries purchase, it doesn't seem possible to me to isolate China from the rest of the world's economy. That seems crazy. I do think that it already has taken place in more specific regions. For instance, technology, you know, this effort by the you know, you could look at the narrow reasons, right? The Germans wanted to buy Huawei's telecom equipment because Huawei was the only country that was the only company that didn't have an NSA backdoor, and the Germans were sick of having all their conversations, you know,
spied on. Is that documented that was the reason why?
Yeah, it's pretty.
That's why I want a Huawei. That's why I want one.
Yeah,
I'm cool with the Chinese government hearing everything I say because I don't consider them a threat to me, but I don't like knowing that like the NSA is watching everything I do, but I can't get a Huawei.
The Chinese aren't going to come knocking at your door to pull you into a black van. You know what I mean? But that could happen. You know what I mean? Like if the Americans are listening to what you say. So I think that there were some narrow reasons like that, but I also think, you know, hey, Huawei makes good phones that are popular in China. They, you know, it's high quality stuff. And I think part of it is just like, you know, we don't want to lose our monopoly on these high-end chips. You know, Huawei and Apple are in this bidding war, or had been in this bidding war for top-end, you know, systems on a chip that are produced mostly in Taiwan, but also in Korea. And, you know, the Apple, with its market power and its, you know, the power of their marketing and all of that, they were able to pay top dollar for this stuff. But Huawei was getting in there as well. And they, you know, China's got a growing middle class that can afford to pay $800 for a smartphone or what have you. So Huawei was able to get in there. And I think the idea of taking some of this very specialized, advanced industrial production techniques and devoting some of it to the unworthy Chinese middle class instead of the American and European middle classes, you know, rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. Not the least, of course, is Apple's market share and profitability as a major American tech company. So I think in arenas like this high tech space, you know, which obviously South Korea and Taiwan being the main producers of this kind of technology, you know, it becomes immediately a geopolitical question as well. You know, given China's role in mediating the North and South Korea crisis, and obviously China's role with relationship with Taiwan, so I think that certain areas it does seem plausible to me to essentially have an economic blockade. I don't think that that's going to be possible in all respects in the way that it was during the Cold War, the original Cold War. But I do think that things like that kind of high technology, it does seem possible. Of course, with respect to Russia, the big question is energy, you know, oil and gas. How can you cut you know, the Americans at this point, because of shale oil and shale gas, you know, we're largely energy self-sufficient at this point in a lot of important respects. And of course, there are a lot of places to get oil apart from Russia that the U.S. can go to. But for Europe, it's a very different situation. It's not really, you know, the cost difference in terms of shipping liquefied natural gas over the Atlantic Ocean versus having a pipeline directly from the source. I mean, it's just an astronomical difference. It can't possibly, I mean, the U.S. can't possibly make up the gap in a cost-efficient way for the average person in Europe. Not to mention European industry is going to face, you know, competitiveness problems if their energy costs go up. So that seems hugely problematic. I don't see how that's, I mean, it's a matter of fact, Russia's an energy superpower. They have something like 10% of the world's natural gas, which is just astonishing. So how you can just try to segment that off from the world economy, and particularly given that China is going to be able to resist these sanctions, and it is going to be very shortly, if not already, the world's largest economy, they're going to be a market for, they'll take whatever minerals and energy Russia wants to sell them and probably get a very favorable price. So they may not be too unhappy with that. But so you're actually not going to be able to cut the Russians out of the global energy market if the world's largest economy is buying up everything they can pump. That element of it just does not seem feasible. And the recent American outreach to, you know, Venezuela is what do you even say about that? The minute they need Venezuelan oil, it just, I mean, there was even an op-ed in the Miami Herald, which I think is, you know, kind of a bellwether for American, you know, received opinion about Latin America, saying that, you know, yeah, you know, Venezuela is good again. They're, you know, they're a democracy, right? The way that the Biden administration is pushing forward these JCPOA talks with Iran when they had previously been dragging their feet, it seems pretty clear that the energy question, I don't know, did they just not think about it or did they not anticipate the consequences? It's very hard for me to understand. But so, yeah, I think the prospects of just a generally splitting the global economy apart doesn't seem possible. But I think in some limited respects, in particular high technology, it does seem to be possible. But energy especially, it does not seem possible at all.
I mean, in the technology in a short term, there could be a U.S. qualitative edge, but how difficult would it be for China to have basic parity, you know, like, I mean, with these things? I mean, Russia, the Russian nuclear doctrine, I heard it was either, I think it was Scott Ritter, I heard him talking about it, and it was set up in a different way than the U.S. Like they don't, the U.S. has such sophisticated radar that they can tell if there's a ballistic missile launched anywhere on the face of the earth.
Right.
Just, okay, I guess that's impressive technologically. I'll grant that. And that Russia doesn't have that. So how does Russia compensate for this? Well, the U.S. response with nuclear weapons has been modified over the years to where it's supposedly like a graduated escalation, you know, that's proportional, yada, yada. Well, the Russians have a different nuclear doctrine, which is if they are attacked with nuclear weapons, it is immediately assumed that they must launch all of their nuclear weapons against their enemies because they don't have as sophisticated a surveillance, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like there are ways to compensate for small differences in technology that they can employ. And so China, I don't, you know, the differences in achievement of between Chinese students and American students, what you really do wonder, like, what is in the long run without huge material disparities in play anymore? How long can the U.S. even have that qualitative advantage over the Chinese? The opportunities lost by not sort of scaling down the empire and coming up with a world sort of governed by international law and so on and working towards arm reduction. I think that is a huge deal. But what do you think is the Chinese role here? Because I look back at it now and think of the timing and, like, you know, the Ukraine coup, the Maidan coup of 2014 happened during the Sochi Olympics and Putin was like there and was sort of preoccupied with that. I don't think that was totally an accident on the U.S. part. And in this case, you had the Chinese-Russian statement before the Olympics that our friendship is the friendliest friendship of any friends who ever befriended each other. And there's no limits to this friendship. Like, they said all of these things, and then you have the Olympics and this hype about the Ukraine invasion. And then they wait, and then there's the Ukraine invasion. I have to guess that China was privy to this. I also have to guess that, I mean, this is what should be, I think, alarming from the American point of view, is none of the steps that America is taking and talking about taking, like, let's kick them off a Swift. Let's get everybody to stop buying their gas. It's not like, oh, surprise, who would have guessed that they would do that? They had to guess that they would do that.
Right.
Like, and that being the case, like, what are the countermeasures that they have in place that would mitigate the problems caused by that if you're Russia? And if you're Russia and China, this seems to be giving them the opportunity to create alternative systems to what the U.S. has been, you know, forcing the world to use for so long. And that the fact that those U.S. systems were accepted has been a pillar of U.S. hegemony, and they seem to be damaging this. So what do you think about the Chinese role here in creating this alternative to American hegemony? And is this going to ultimately really bite the Americans in the ass in terms of giving rise to exactly what they were trying to prevent?
Yeah, I mean, that joint statement even mentioned I don't know if it mentioned Ukraine specifically, but it definitely mentioned Russia's, you know, security ultimatums that they issued, you know, with respect to just generally speaking the situation between NATO and Russia. So it's not even just like in general China's, you know, on Russia's side with respect to this stuff. It's like very specifically in terms of Russia's European policy, like they're very much, you know, on the same side with respect to this. And that's like, you know, I mean, this is just shaping up to be a military confrontation between these two blocks, you know, which is just could be catastrophic for the planet. I mean, and that's really, I think, China is the most normal country on Earth in the sense that it's the, you know, biggest economy, and there's nothing like special about China other than it's just big. Right, it doesn't have particularly natural resources. Doesn't have a particularly great geographical position on Earth. You know, like in the sense that the U.S. right is like this world island, right, totally separated from any of its geopolitical rivals. You know, China, meanwhile, is on the Eurasian landmass. You know, has border problems with India. Has historically had border problems with Russia. You know, but nonetheless, you know, they've you know gotten themselves to this point. And it seems to me, I mean, even with respect to this, to the European crisis that's happening right now, I've even seen stuff where people in Europe, where, you know, statespeople in Europe are calling on China to play some role in mediating this because of the Chinese relationship with Europe and because of the Chinese relationship with Russia. And, you know, Europe and China just negotiated, I think maybe in 2018 or 2019, a big sort of regime of trade liberalization. You know, pretty clearly setting up China to have that role, providing consumer goods to Europe as Europe, you know, continues to deindustrialize, which is, I guess, a separate issue. But yeah, it seems to me that China is you know, well on its way to being the world's premier economic power. You know, as far as their military, they're pretty under strength compared to how, you know, predominant they are economically. And it doesn't seem, again, you know, just speaking about the geography of the situation, the U.S. can afford to mess around and muck around in Asia or in Africa or in Europe because it doesn't really affect the U.S. in a direct way. But China has a very different situation. I mean, they have huge land borders with all of these different countries. And so they have to manage their, you know, diplomacy and in a very, very different way than the Americans. You know, they just can't. They can't do the things that the U.S. has done because of their vulnerability, just in a very basic sense. So I think all of this shapes China to be a very, very different power than the U.S. had been historically. And, you know, I don't think there's anything that the U.S. can do about that at this point. I mean, what do you do? The U.S. itself imports, I mean, basically the consumer political economy of the U.S. is reliant on China, leaving aside the issues of, you know, Chinese purchase of T-bills and things like that. just the very basics of how Americans get the stuff they need to go about their daily lives is highly interrelated with the Chinese, you know, productive apparatus. So, you know, I it is baffling to me. I don't understand. And at least in the past, it was some you could identify some logic in the way that, for instance, Nixon and Kissinger, you know, bringing China into the American fold, you know, as against the Soviet Union, or some of the reverse that was happening, where the Soviet Union and Russia, you know, they're trying to bring that into the American fold, you know, despite Russia, despite China during the 90s, when China was beginning to join, you know, the WTO and other international institutions. But now it's like antagonizing both of them at the same time, in a way that negatively affects the main American partner in the Eurasian landmass, which is Europe. What is the logic there? I don't know. You know, I have American strategic thinkers just accepted a more sort of a smaller American empire, but more tightly controlled? You know, what is the long-term thinking there? I don't know. I mean, how do you read that? Like, how can, in the face of this, what can American planners be thinking about? What, you know, where can they be shoring up? You know, what are they considering at this point?
Yeah, I wish that I knew, because I don't see any way that they can reverse the tide of history here. I think that they attempted at the turn of the century with the War on Terror, they attempted to parlay this into a series of campaigns that would remake the energy heartlands of the world in the Middle East, and would even get into Central Asia and achieve hegemony there. You know, that's a big part of why Afghanistan was occupied for two decades, you know, that it sits right in between Iran, China, and Russia. Okay. And so it was extremely valuable in that way, for purposes laid out by people like Brzezinski, you know, and people who are thinking along like Halford Mackinder lines. But the U.S. has failed there. And then under Obama, they attempt to revive this with a human rights flavored campaign. You know, first with like Libya taking down another regime that was, you know, guilty of resource nationalism and didn't want to strictly be in the U.S. orbit. And then Russia saw that. I mean, that situation where the U.S. made a deal with Gaddafi to give up his weapons of mass destruction in exchange for being promised that he would be welcomed into the fold. And ultimately, he was still too independent, and they, you know, they destroyed his country and they murdered him in the most grisly way imaginable. And Russia learned from that. And they've explicitly said, Americans are agreement incapable. You cannot make agreements with them. You cannot reason with them. And they came to regret abstaining from the National Security Council vote that ended up creating that so-called no-fly zone, which really ended up being a you know, regime change operation, complete with victory defilement of the head of state that was targeted. Something that's quite unique, gets put on the internet as a sort of TikTok video or something, right? Of Gaddafi getting reamed by our jihadi proxies, and they saw that, and then they intervened to keep that from happening again in Syria. Obama still has a halo in America, despite doing these tremendously sinister things. I mean, what the U.S. did in Libya is so far worse than anything that Vladimir Putin has ever done. And yet Obama can walk around with his wife and be, you know, given sort of saint status. And Michelle, you can see those pictures of Michelle Obama hugging George W. Bush, you know, another criminal, another very prolific criminal. And we just go on this way. But they failed there too, though. They failed in Syria, and all of the propaganda there, the white helmets and the moderate rebels and all of it in the Arab Spring now seems very suspect. And you think back on it now and think like, yeah, God, remember how it was like all Twitter and Facebook and Tahrir Square and all those Twitter accounts that popped up when the Libyan war was going on? Like, that's thinking about that now, it's like, oh yeah, of course. We're more aware of how the social media is an arm of the state. People weren't thinking that way then. I thought like, there's no way that those are organic Twitter accounts. Like, I was saying all this to people in grad school, political science. And of course they were like, I was considered a weirdo there, but I didn't really care because I'm immune to normal social, you know, things. Apparently, it just it doesn't bother me if I'm the only person saying like, "This is the crime. This is the crime of the century," whatever. Like, but it was like pretty clear then, but it's even more clear now. They have failed in those things, and so where do they go now? I mean, they whatever happened in Kazakhstan seems to have been some kind of Hail Mary from U.S. deep state actors, probably with help from Turkish people. They had to just straight up invade Syria to occupy a part of that place where they're supposedly fighting ISIS, and yet you wonder if they're really fighting them or like pretending to fight them while protecting them, because now there are reports that those people are being sent into Ukraine as well. I mean, it just seems like they are desperate and rudderless in terms of having any sane course of action in front of them. And I don't know where it can lead, because China is the world's greatest civilization. They had a shitty couple of centuries thanks to these huge technological disparities with the West. And they've had some hardships over the years, like their proximity to these nomadic peoples to the north that would come and, you know, mess them up every once in a while. The Xiongnu and the Han Dynasty, and then, of course, the Mongols most famously, right? But in the past, when the Mongols took over China, they didn't Mongolicize the Chinese. The right. Mongol invaders became Sinicized, became Chinese themselves because of the deep roots that civilization has in that part of the world. And there's really nothing like it in the West, and nothing that Americans can even really conceptualize, because we don't know much history anyway. So I think that we just don't. The people in charge do not know what they're doing. To some extent, they believe way too much of their own propaganda. Thankfully, the Pentagon seems to actually have at least one toe in the world of reality. And so they're pushing back against those nerdy NPR liberals who are calling for nuclear Armageddon, another strange development. So this is, I don't see where they go. It's Dale Scott said in that, in our last oral history series interview, he said, "This is Scott's law, that no empire responds rationally to a decline in its own power." And I think that that is absolutely the case. The optimistic case of an empire accepting its decline is the British. But that's because they had a very unique situation where they were just handing their empire over, their imperial responsibilities over, to another group of Anglos who basically left their country, you know, many, many years before, and would protect their investments overseas. And so Britain got the option of becoming America's little thug buddy, little junior thug buddy, satellite. Whenever we want to bomb some, you know, people somewhere, we can always count on the Brits to give us a, you know, cheerio. Yes, you know, like, yes, sir, to, you know, Tony Blair to George Bush, right? They're always like our little yes man.
Yeah.
But I don't see how the U.S. has so distorted its entire economy with imperial privilege and the status of the dollar to the point that we abuse this power, creating trillions of dollars to prop up these financial markets that, by the logic that they used to employ, would have been rendered insolvent or, you know, in crisis. But because we have this magic money machine, we create that. And there's such a disconnect between the way that that works and the way that Americans talk about things. They're always saying like, how are you going to pay for this? And we can't be unrealistic about wanting this or that. When in reality, this entire thing is based purely on like magical a power that's derived from the U.S. status as controlling the money machine. It's like people would say money doesn't grow on trees, but the U.S. has this power that it's not even as tangible as something. It's worse than money growing on trees.
Money flowing from the barrel of a gun.
And from keyboards, because you have that power. I mean, so I don't see where the U.S. can go from here. And I don't see how they can resist any of really Russia's demands. The only way you're going to do that is like the U.S. is basically saying, Russia is saying, we have these demands, which are kind of reasonable. The U.S. is saying, oh yeah, well, no way. Not over the dead bodies of all of Ukraine will you have those things. Yeah. And they're going to like, actually, who's really responsible for what unfolds in Ukraine? You know, like the U.S. doesn't seem to want to let their puppet negotiate with Russia. So they're essentially consigning these people to a hopeless cause. Is the propaganda machine so powerful that if this, as this unfolds, they can keep that fact from becoming widely acknowledged in the U.S. populace, or how can they even manage this shit that's unfolding?
That's the thing, is that the push to militarize the relationship between the U.S. and Russia and China, which I think has always been, you know, pretty much under the surface to the extent that the U.S. has militarized its relationship with every country on Earth, but to push that to the limit in the way that is happening right now, but the thing is, how long can that last? Because the reality is that what we've come up against in Ukraine is that the U.S. cannot just do whatever it wants militarily with respect to that situation. There are limits to the power there. So it is odd. The other thing about, it's this paradoxical thing about the U.S. dollar, is that, you know, at precisely the moment when de-dollarization seems, you know, on the docket, you know, you were talking about China and Russia figuring out ways to settle their transactions without reference to the U.S. dollar, for instance. On the other hand, the U.S. dollar is doing great because in times of crisis, it's what people flock to. And, you know, how much of that is inertia, you know, to some extent it probably is, but I think it's also a recognition of, you know, the U.S. does have supreme military capability, particularly in terms of a global, you know, you could say Russia is, you know, hegemonic in Eastern Europe, for instance, but in terms of a global, you know, military power, the U.S. is definitely that. And so if you're going to bank on, in the final analysis, you know, if you're going to bank on something, you're going to bank on the U.S. military. You know, as much as that's a risky investment, it's probably still the safest investment at this point. And so that just creates has created for a very long time, very perverse incentives, because really that's what the U.S. dollar is rooted in at this point, is that military capability such as it is. And you were talking earlier about this idea that the British handed over, you know, you could say first the Dutch, you know, were forced by a major European war to essentially abandon their imperial aspirations more or less. And then it passed to the British, who were more than happy to hand it to the broader, you know, community of global Anglos. But, you know, if you were a rational American business leader, you would say, well, you know, and this is true to some extent, these currents do exist. You know, China's the world's largest economy. You know, we need to make our peace with that situation. Just if you're looking at your balance sheet, and particularly if you're looking at where your, you know, your growing markets are in terms of where's the growing middle class in the world, it's in China. But the idea that there's a huge disconnect, you know, you could say in the British to American handover of empire, there was kind of a congruence of the economic considerations and the political considerations. But right now, there's a huge disconnect between the economic considerations and the political considerations. And, you know, in the extent to which the British and the Americans were able to form these tight, you know, military and political bonds with a variety of different treaties and things like this, you know, I don't think that the U.S. is going to be tagging along to some Chinese military intervention anytime soon, right? I don't think that's going to happen. So how does that problem get resolved? I don't think it gets resolved, like you say, I don't think it gets resolved the same way that the last, you know, transition from economic power to economic power got handed off. Not the least, of course, you know, the British are a sea power and the United States is mostly a sea power, and that was the operative way for managing that empire. For the Chinese, you know, with this Belt and Road, whether you want to call that imperialism or not, it's clearly very different from the kind of sea power that the West carried out. So there was also even like a kind of operational congruence there in terms of how the power was carried out. China's model is completely different just because of the fact that they're on the Eurasian landmass and they have a, you know, completely different way of economically integrating with other countries. So it just doesn't seem to match up, and it sets the stage for some kind of confrontation that I hope is not military, but I fear may ultimately be.
Yeah, it can't be nuclear. This, no matter how insane right. you are, you could explain to someone in an hour that, okay, nuclear war must be avoided at all costs. It's unwinnable and it's a disaster. With the U.S. case, China does not, unless the U.S. is able to reverse course quickly, China would not. I mean, could the U.S. expect China to give it the treatment of the British after World War II? You know, yeah. I mean, even the British tried to hold on to their empire, fought with the Suez Crisis, and then, you know, conspiring with the French and the Israelis to
failed massively.
It did, but it was, you know, the Dulleses wanted to, Allen, they wanted to actually come down on the British side, and they were foiled in that because of other concerns that Eisenhower had about wanting to look good for these, you know, darker nations of the world that the U.S. was trying to befriend, and that this was a bad look. So this, like, it all exploded in their faces. But would the Chinese, I mean, the U.S. has so tried to stymie everything that China has done. I mean, the Tiananmen Square, there was a U.S. hand in that that's never been totally exposed, but enough has been for you to say, like, okay, there was this that likely had some, and almost certainly had some CIA, National Endowment for Democracy, chicanery going on there. Gene Sharp was there right before the protests got really serious, which is pretty damning evidence. They encouraged uprisings during the Beijing Olympics, right? I mean, in Tibet things, the U.S. in all likelihood was coordinating that to try to humiliate the Japanese. They talked so much shit during this last Olympics about China as much as they could. They did that shit with the tennis star, probably ruined her life by supposedly like trying to help her who was like raped by someone, except then the more you look into it, it's like actually never happened. And yet that became a huge thing. There's so many examples of the U.S. being so dickish towards the Chinese in every opportunity that you have to wonder, will the Chinese have any reason to not hold a grudge against the U.S. as a whole or what? I mean, this part is baffling. But the last thing I want to ask you about here before I let you go is this, because it's such a strange and disturbing aspect of this whole thing. And that is the biological weapons issue in Ukraine that has come to the fore. At first, it was reported on, and then the U.S. said, oh, this is disinformation. There's no such thing here. And then they're saying, oh, well, yeah, we guess we did have them there, but they were for defensive purposes. What do you make of this whole angle to the Ukraine thing? I mean, to me, it sort of suggests that the U.S. really may not have expected the Russians to come in because the exposure should have been predictable. And yet they didn't. So what the hell are we to make of this?
Yeah, well, I mean, first off, just the question of like, what is going on here? It's definitely been reported. You know, I remember reading reports about similar types. There's a Luger, I think it's called the Luger Center lab in Georgia outside Tbilisi, I believe, that is doing similar kind of research on these kinds of pathogens. You know, ironically named after Luger, who, you know, was an arms, you know, pushed for arms control. And yet here's this, you know, effectively a biological weapons lab that is being run in his name. But even this, I mean, crucially, this kind of defensive research, like the kind of stuff that the DTRA, Defense Threat Reduction Agency, does, and this is a great pretext because, oh, it's defensive. We're not making offensive weapons. But even defensive research is illegal under U.S. law. I mean, the guy who wrote the law, Francis Boyle, I mean, he said as much. I mean, he's the guy who wrote the actual act, which was signed by Bush, you know, and it to sort of enable the sort of broader treaty that the U.S. had signed on to that was kind of under international auspices. So, you know, straightforwardly, I mean, even what they've already admitted to is technically illegal under U.S. domestic law and international law if they were doing this kind of research even for defensive purposes. And the fact that it was apparently so close to the Russian border. I've even seen the Russian government has alleged or hinted at the idea that some of these outbreaks of like livestock diseases in parts of Russia were perhaps associated with this. And the U.S. has, the U.S. has a history of engaging in bioweapons.
It's lying about it.
Yeah. Well, even this whole thing about, I mean, you can even trace some of the roots of MK Ultra back to this, right? These pilots in Korea dropping, you know, plague bombs, you know, as a way of just basically field research to see would this work, and then they get captured and they admit to it because they knew what they were doing, and you know, supposedly they've been brainwashed by the Chinese to admit to using bioweapons, you know. But even the Cuban government has talked about these dengue fever outbreaks in Cuba, having been associated with American bioweapons research. So it's a, you know, I would be very surprised if all of the major powers on Earth were not engaged in this kind of bioweapons research, because it's a clearly has a some kind of strategic value to be able to release outbreaks of diseases in other countries to further your interests. But the way that the U.S. has pushed it up to the borders of its opponents and put people, you know, for instance, there's a lab in Korea, in South Korea, that the U.S. runs, which has faced tons of opposition from people who live there because they don't want to live near a bioweapons research laboratory. Why would you want to? And for the Americans, of course, you don't have to put any of your own citizens in danger if you have this lab in a foreign country, and it's basically unaccountable except for on a state-to-state basis where the U.S. obviously holds all the cards and the client state holds none of the cards. So there's no way for the for any kind of domestic opposition to push it out. It's just a really, really alarming situation. I hope we get, you know, documents that we can look at. You know, I mean, obviously the Russian government is going to push, you know, their particular propaganda line about this, you know, which may be based in reality in some respects. So I would love to start to see some of these documents come out. But I did see that a Twitter account that had published some of the documents got banned, I guess, for publishing these documents. And, you know, we deserve transparency. We deserve disclosure on this. You know, the Chinese government in particular has said, look, you know, let's have foreign observers enter the fort. You know, if the IEA, if the International Atomic Energy Agency can send observers to Iran's, you know, peaceful civilian nuclear facilities, you know, why shouldn't there be an international group that sends observers to American disease labs? I think that's only fair and just. I hope that that kind of thing does happen, because otherwise we're not going to get any kind of transparency into what these people are doing.
Yeah, the MK Ultra angle is also totally wild, and it's not widely understood. Jeffrey Kay has written a number of articles on documenting how the U.S. was, in fact, using biological weapons in Korea. The U.S. denied all of those things. And then they say, because these they had testimony from captured U.S. people, then they say, oh, well, it must be that there's a brainwashing gap. There's a gap. And we need to close the gap. So we'll start this MKUltra program with mind control, and we'll brainwash people too. So we'll learn how to like catch up to their arts, and we'll train people how to resist, and et cetera, et cetera. When in reality, like those soldiers were apparently telling the truth.
Yeah.
But then the U.S. uses it as a pretext to launch like the most insane and sinister, you know, mind control research and drug research on unwitting subjects, et cetera, et cetera. And then as far as living next to a lab that's doing this kind of research, that's the case for the Lyme disease issue, is that there's a, it's like Plum Island, right? It's like right off the coast. Yeah, and then Lyme, I believe, is the name of the town that's on the U.S. mainland, right next to that U.S. military installation where, among other things, they had Nazis that they had rescued doing research on tick-borne illnesses. And that's where Lyme disease just happens to emerge. But the official word on that is that that's a coincidence from the U.S. So they you know, they lie about all of these things. There's reason to suspect that the Frank Olson case, the reason that he was murdered was that they were worried he would start to talk about the MK Ultra, you know, biological weapons research and the use of these things in the Korean War. And so it was such potentially bad PR for the U.S. that they may have just killed him. You know, they may have, I mean, for whatever reason, he seems to have been eliminated by the state. James McCord was involved in that, which is quite fascinating. And that's where they go. So the U.S. has this long history of lying about these things and carrying them out. And they absolutely should be opened up and discussed. It's also terrifying that this kind of research would exist besides great power conflicts. You just think about the elites and their problems over society and these other issues that they're not dealing with, like global warming, you know, and as AI advances and, you know, you from their perspective that like this human civilization and mass consumption is not really tenable, but AI can kind of substitute for most of the menial jobs that people do. Well, what are they going to do with this excess population? I mean, it's shit that makes you feel very paranoid to even think about, but these people have demonstrated a total lack of regard for human life. They don't mind putting all of humanity at risk with nuclear weapons and so on. They don't mind doing things like slaughtering, you know, a million Indonesian rice farmers just to make sure that they can like get access to natural resources in this, in that country. I mean, there seems to be no limit to their depravity. And so what can we even do about this? Or what's the right thing to even think about it? I mean, at least the Chinese are saying, hey, let's have some transparency and some openness here.
Yeah.
I mean, because it needs to be done. It's horrifying to, when you think about what the potential applications are and what the track record is of the people in power here.
Yeah, I agree. The U.S. has done very little. The U.S. government has done very little to really, you know, convince you that they're a responsible steward of human society. And, you know, when you consider the weapons that they have at their disposal, the question of these kinds of things coming into use during a serious crisis when, unless something is done, the planet is headed for a potentially existential crisis, right, with respect to the environmental problems that we face and the serious disruption of just the basics of, you know, getting people fed and getting people water and things. And so, you know, once that truly existential level crisis starts to hit, what kinds of things become that were off the table are now on the table. And I'd feel a lot better if the option of biological weapons or the option of nuclear weapons was not in the hands of these people. That would really help me sleep at night.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm kind of immersed in this stuff to the point that like, I can really think about really grim stuff and just be happy that, hey, you know what? Doomsday may be coming, but it's not today. And so I'm gonna do my best to not let this overwhelm me, because it is overwhelming. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us again here, and we're gonna resume the Peter Dale Scott oral history series as soon as we can, and there may be some other exciting stuff in the works coming up. So Ben Howard, it's always great.
Thank you, Aaron, appreciate it.
Big thanks again to the great Ben Howard for joining us. He was excellent as ever, this time on no notice. We will resume our Peter Dale Scott series soon. I hope that you all have enjoyed those Peter Dale Scott episodes as much as we have enjoyed making them. I re-listened to part 3 again while I was playing Elden Ring, and even after hearing it twice before, I thought it was the perfect thing to listen to while I was wandering the world. But of course, I'm a huge and longtime admirer of Peter's, as you know. I want to thank Dana Chavarria for engineering the audio, and Casey Moore for the artwork. I also have to thank Mock Orange for putting us into high-octane punk mode with their music. Mind the darkness, friends.